Anybody have any idea about what the chance would be a healthy woman, 25 years old, having sex for a year without using any kind of birth control? What do you think the odds are? If you, let's take 100 women having sex for a year without birth control. How many would you be pregnant by the end of the year?
Nine.
9 out of 100?
Or 190 out of 100?
85. 85, you're pretty close. So the pregnancy, the general pregnancy rate is 85%. So if you know somebody who says, well, I've been having sex for 2 years and I've never gotten pregnant, I must be infertile. She's not infertile, she's lucky. Okay. So the pregnancy rate for healthy people is very high. So any kind of method that we use is going to reduce that significantly. Well, I guess I better pull the screen now, huh? So this slide looks at, can you guys see that? Should I turn the lights off?
I can help.
This is expressed as failure rate, which means pregnancy rate. So if you say no method, 85% are going to get pregnant. And this is the ideal rate here, if you use the method perfectly the way it's intended. And this is the typical user rate, presuming that some women will forget to take pills sometimes. People will say their method is a diaphragm, but they won't put it in, that sort of thing. So you see, any method that you use, even the one with the highest failure rate, 20 or 21%, is still a vast improvement over 85%. So no matter which method you use, you're going to do way better than using nothing at all. And we'll talk about some specifics of these. We start with the most natural method, the rhythm method. This was the one that didn't work for those women 100 years ago, trying to space out their families. What that revolves around is knowing what your menstrual cycle is like. This line here is a temperature chart, taking your temperature every morning. This is one that women use also when they're trying to get pregnant. This, of course, is the developing egg and ovulation, or the egg coming out. So the time right around ovulation is the time when you can most easily get pregnant. Unfortunately, you don't know at the beginning of the cycle when ovulation is going to take place. For most women who have a 28-day cycle, it's probably going to happen about day 14. But some women have ovulated when they're having a period, or sometime in here. So the only time in the cycle that you can really be sure is out here when you know that you've already ovulated and you didn't get pregnant. And that's a hard time to be sure of. So there is a technique of measuring, checking temperature, checking cervical mucus, that's what these are here, looking at cervical mucus, to determine the time of ovulation. But this is something that requires, to do this successfully, requires a lot of daily involvement and daily attention to your body, checking cervical mucus and taking temperatures.
Is this your body temperature?
This is a basal body temperature with a thermometer.
And how many degrees does it change when you ovulate?
This is about 97.5 right here, and this is about 98.5, so it goes up about a degree.
A degree. Huh.
So that's because this area in the ovary, after the egg has left, this guy right here produces progesterone. And progesterone is thermogenic, meaning it increases your body temperature by just that little amount. The problem is that this is not prospective, so you can't tell when it's coming up. You can only say after the fact, aha, I ovulated.
Yeah, right.
So for this purpose, it isn't all that useful. Now if we look at other barrier methods, we're looking at failure rates that are somewhere in the teens to the 20s, but still, again, much better than no method at all. The male condom by itself is expensive, inexpensive, and available everywhere, including up in the outside the nurse's station here in Agape, just in a little cup right outside the door. spermicides. These methods, all of them do better when you use more than one. So a spermicide and a condom, or a diaphragm with spermicide, all of these are going to, they're going to increase your effectiveness with each one. Spermicide, condom, and a female condom, which is a new method, you don't have to get a prescription for it. You can just go in the drugstore and buy it. I had trouble finding a female condom. They are available, and it's called Reality. I couldn't even find one to bring. I didn't go to the right place, I think. But I have some pictures of what it looks like. The vaginal sponge, unfortunately, is off the market. Not because there was anything wrong with it. I think the manufacturer wasn't making enough money on it. It actually was a good product, but it's not around anymore. Please feel free to speak up if you have questions about anything. Because I'm going to go through this kind of quickly. This is what it looks like to put in a diaphragm. A diaphragm looks like this. Anybody wants to take a look at it? It's made out of rubber. It's a barrier. That means it prevents sperm from getting into the uterus and into the fallopian tubes where fertilization takes place. It needs to be sized by a doctor or a healthcare provider. And then it needs to be put in within several hours before intercourse, and it needs to be left in for at least 6 hours. You can just pull these things up right here. I'm going to pass a few other things around too. This is not, you can't feel it while it's in there. Works best if you put spermicide on the inside of it. Some people think that a diaphragm actually works as a vehicle for holding the spermicide. The spermicide is the jelly that actually kills the sperm. Some people think it works more that way than it does as a physical barrier, because it's not an absolute barrier. A cervical cap is another version of a barrier method that has been around for a long time, but only recently approved by the FDA within the last couple of years, mainly, I think, for political reasons, because none of the drug companies are going to make big money on these, because you only have to buy it once every 3 or 4 years, not like birth control pills you have to buy every month. So they're not big on not promoting these. So the cervical cap fits right over the cervix by suction. So here's a cervical cap, and that puts spermicide in too. The advantage of the cap is that some women tend to have trouble with bladder infections or bladder irritation from the diaphragm, because it sits, the front rim of the diaphragm can sit right here against the, and press against the urethra, compress the urethra between the diaphragm and the pubic bone, which is right here. So the cervical cap works better for some women for that reason. It's less obtrusive.
I don't quite get it though.
Don't get how it works?
Yeah.
Okay.
I don't get what's different.
Okay. It's smaller for one thing.
Right.
And this just fits right over the cervix like that, and it makes a suction. What the diaphragm does is that it sits in the vagina. Instead of just sitting over the cervix, it sits in the vagina.
Uh-huh.
And it takes up more space. So the cap fits just over the cervix itself.
And it's got to stay on, though, but it does.
Right.
Because of suction.
Right. And it has to be sized to fit your particular cervix. This is the female condom, if you can picture how that works. It's like a diaphragm at the top, and then it has a tube of material, which is polypropylene, I think, sort of like a cross between saran wrap and wax paper, unfortunately, which leads to one of its drawbacks is that it's a little noisy. So it's like this, it has this tube, and then at the other end it has another ring that's bigger. So that this outer ring kind of lays against the vulva, so it provides some protection on the outside, as well as this tube that's kind of protecting here, so obviously you go up inside here, so the whole vagina would be protected. It's a great idea. The product isn't real great, so it's not having real great success, but it is a way that women can take this barrier idea completely into their own hands, because some women either aren't able to or don't want to insist on their partners using condoms, male condoms. I don't have a slide about, and we'll come back to the condoms in a minute, male condoms. I don't have a slide about IUDs, but I do have an IUD to show you. And an IUD is a method that is best used by women who've had all the children they want to have, because there is an incidence of infection associated with it, primarily at the time that it's inserted. Sorry, we played with this earlier with the younger girls. It's got a little bin out of shape. This is a nice method for women who are done having children but aren't really, really quite ready for sterilization yet, because once you have this put in, it can stay in for 10 years. Okay, this is called a Paragard, which is a T-shaped IUD that has copper on it, and it works by preventing implantation. So once fertilization occurs, then the fertilized egg is not able to implant. Isn't able to fix onto the uterine wall.
Is that a chemical thing or is it a physical?
It's a both. So it's the device itself. So a device without copper on it works just by being in there, mm-hmm. and the copper adds to that.
Mm-hmm.
There is also an IUD called a Progestacert, which has progesterone on it instead of metal, and it works by changing the nature of the uterine lining. And that one has to be replaced every year, which makes it less popular than this one.
And where is that one at? Where do you put that? Is that in your
cervix? It goes inside the uterus. Okay, so this is a uterus.
The whole thing?
That whole thing? Yeah, I'm going to show you how it goes. How it goes in. It goes in through, this is put in by a healthcare professional. And it goes up in through the cervix. I never tried doing it in this position before. Yeah, and then we cut the string off so it's in there it hangs out about an inch out through the cervix, so then you can check every month after your period, be sure that the string is still there. And it's painless once it's in there. Sometimes women have a little bit more cramping with their periods, or a little bit longer periods when they have an IUD.
What are the side effects in the long run?
With long-term side effects, you mean damage to your body or anything?
Right.
None. If you don't get an infection from it, then it doesn't cause any sort of a problem. And most women don't get infected. It's ideal for women who are in a monogamous relationship who are not at risk of getting a sexually transmitted infection and want to have birth control that lasts for a long time. It wouldn't be something you'd want to use in between kids, because it's good for 10 years and it costs several hundred dollars to get it put in. So over the lifetime of the device, it's, you know, it pays for itself, but for a year or two, it wouldn't be worthwhile. Now, hormonal methods are one of the ways that, as we said, a lot of women are using for birth control pills, and other hormones. What the hormonal methods do is to interrupt this process, which I'm sure you all recognize. These are the hormones that change during the menstrual cycle, and this is the development of the egg about at day 14, as we said, ovulation, and then the second half of the cycle lasting another 14 days or so before the period. So what birth control pills and other hormonal methods do is they interfere with these hormones here that are produced by your pituitary gland, and they make them perfectly straight instead of having these levels, and the follicles in the ovaries never develop. You still have periods on birth control pills only because you stop taking the hormones for a week. So you take hormones for 3 weeks and things are perfectly straight like this, then you stop taking them for a week and your uterine lining sloughs off and you start taking them again. The other methods, as we'll see, you don't even have a period necessarily. I'm going to quiz you on this one later. I'm just kidding. These are the various different ways that birth control pills work. They suppress ovulation by these various methods. They also change the cervical mucus. You know, at ovulation, you have that long, stretchy, clear mucus. And that is, the reason it's long and stretchy is to direct the sperm right up into the uterus. That's why it's that way, because it enhances pregnancy. So what birth control pills do is they make that mucus thick and tacky, so it doesn't do that same process. Also probably changes things inside the uterus and in the fallopian tubes. So birth control pills are very effective. Something like, what did we say on our original one? 97% effective even in user effectiveness rate. So even the way people tend to take them, which is occasionally forgetting a pill or going on vacation and not starting them on time, that sort of thing, you still get very, very good success. Doesn't interfere with having sexual activity like the barrier methods do. Obviously, you have to think about it at the time for those. These, you take one pill every single day and you get in the habit. There is a significant reduction in the incidence of ovarian cancer in women who have taken birth control pills. The longer you take it, the lower your risk of ovarian cancer. And that is probably, we think, because whenever you ovulate and an egg comes out of your ovary, it causes trauma to the surface of the ovary. And the body has to repair that trauma. And whenever the body is in a repair mode, more cells get made and more activity goes on. And when you're on birth control pills, you're not doing that. That trauma isn't happening. So we think that that's why there's a reduction in ovarian cancer. So in fact, we recommend birth control pills for that reason for women who have a family history of ovarian cancer, that is in a mother or sister, because the reduction is so significant. Also reduces the risk of endometrial cancer, cancer inside the uterus. Many women are taking birth control pills because it helps them with menstrual cramps, heavy bleeding, reduces the flow, reduces anemia. It's easy to stop. You just stop taking it, the next month you ovulate again, most often. Doesn't provide any protection from STDs like the barrier methods do. Sometimes there are dangerous complications, but not very often. And there are some side effects that some women can't tolerate. These are some different kinds of birth control pills. There are, gosh, I don't know exactly how many there are on the market right now. Probably at least 20 different kinds of pills. So that a woman who says, I can't possibly take birth control pills because I had headaches or because I got nauseated, kids certainly try other pills. So there are many things that can be shifted around. This is, again, a list of non-contraceptive benefits. So the other things that you get an advantage from taking birth control pills. Reduction in these kinds of cancers, fewer tubal pregnancies, which typically require an operation to deal with, periods that are more regular, and some of these other things that we think may be improved. These are other gynecological problems. Endometriosis is a painful process with menstrual periods, fewer fibroids, and fewer ovarian cysts. So that women who take birth control pills tend to have fewer gynecological problems in general, especially if they've been on them for a while. Now, you might have heard that birth control pills are real dangerous, that, you know, you can't take them if you smoke, or you can't take them if you're over 35, or you can have a heart attack. And it's true that there is an increased incidence of cardiovascular disease in women who take birth control pills, but that risk is primarily in women who are over 35 who smoke. So this is mortality rate for 100,000 users. And this line in the back here, this is women in their 40s who smoke more than a pack a day. So they have a rate, mortality rate of 60 per 100,000. And it goes down considerably even for heavy smokers if they're younger. So I've had teenagers say to me, oh, I can't take birth control pills because I smoke. Well, number one, they shouldn't smoke. But number two, you're much better off to take birth control pills and still smoke than you are not to use a method of birth control at all. This is the death rate from pregnancy. So in these younger ages, you're more likely to die from being pregnant than you are from taking birth control pills. And way less likely to die from birth control pills if you don't smoke, or you smoke a small amount here. Is that clear? Mm-hmm. So they're safe and effective. Depo-Provera, you might have heard about. This is an every 3 month injection, and this is only progesterone. Now, birth control pills contain both hormones that our ovaries make, estrogen and progesterone. Depo-Provera only contains progesterone. It is very effective, more effective than birth control pills. And it is very safe and is not associated with that cardiovascular risk. And for women who can't take a product that has estrogen in it, it works well for them. The major problem with Depo-Provera is that there may be irregular bleeding. So most women will stop having periods altogether, which, if the periods are a problem, can be an added benefit. Some women have trouble with weight gain and sometimes some mood symptoms, so that can be a bit of a problem for them as well.
This is just one shot?
One shot every 3 months.
And it stays in your system that
long?
Right.
It's a depo.
How expensive is that?
It's cheap.
Really?
It's cheap because it's been around for a long time. I could look it up for you. I don't have it at my fingertips, but it's like, I don't know, $25 every 3 months.
Mm-hmm.
It's cheap. You have to go to the doctor's office to get it. So that adds a little bit to the
cost.
What
do birth control pills cost?
They cost about $30 a month.
Really?
Usually, yeah.
Wow.
Uh-huh.
Well, nowadays they have the generic, so you can get it cheaper.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. But the generics are something like 15 or 20. I mean, they're not real cheap.
Huh.
Depends on what kind of it. The other thing about Depo-Provera is that sometimes when women stop getting it, instead of 3 months after their last shot when they'd be due for another one starting to have periods again, sometimes it can take a year or two before they get their periods back. So this is not necessarily a good method for women who are just trying to delay having a baby if it's a short time. If they're trying to delay it for a number of years, it can work well.
Does that happen like on a regular basis, like quite a few of them, or?
No. But it's not unusual for periods to take at least 6 months to come back after that. Norplant is another hormonal method that's been out for several years. This method uses six little tiny thin cylinders or rods that have progesterone in them, and they're implanted under the skin in the upper arm, and they're put in there by, you know, the doctor or health professional. And then they stay there for 5 years. You don't have to do anything else about it. Put it in, forget about it. Most women don't have periods on this method. It says here, can stop the menstrual cycle. My experience, most women have stopped having periods until they get close to the time that it needs to be replaced. This, again, is extremely effective and safe, doesn't have a lot of side effects associated with it, except for some women, weight gain again, and the irregular bleeding. And for women who are thin, don't have a lot of subcutaneous fat on their arm, sometimes you can see it. Usually you can feel it, even if you can't see it, but it's in a pretty unobtrusive place.
And do they just kind of inject them, or do they have to cut?
Well, you have to cut a very small incision and then put them in. You sort of put them in in a fan shape like this.
Mm-hmm.
And then when you remove it, you have to make another very small incision and pull them out. The removal is a little more difficult than the insertion, as you can imagine, because your body tries to heal around something that's in there. So now let's just look for a minute at, this is again risk of death. It's not that we think about dying from our birth control method, but just to give you some perspective. This is the risk of driving a car, chance of death, 1 in 6,000 in a year. The risk of using birth control pills, if you don't smoke, the risk of dying would be 1 in 63,000. If you're a smoker, it's still 1 in 16,000. An IUD is much safer in terms of death. They're listing no death here based on these barrier methods that we talked about. Sterilization, again, low risk except for hysterectomy, which is a major surgery and not recommended as a birth control method. Continuing a pregnancy would be a 1 in 11,000 risk of death, and that's from pregnancy complications like toxemia of pregnancy. Abortions are also quite safe in the early stage of pregnancy. Later on, it becomes more risky. It's more of a major operation. I wouldn't consider abortion as a birth control method, but I do talk to women when I counsel them about choosing a birth control method about what would you do if you did get pregnant. And depending on the circumstances, if a woman says, I can't possibly have a pregnancy now because I'm going to be going to seminary for the next 4 years, it just would be horrible. But I never would have an abortion if I did get pregnant. Then we want to choose something like a birth control pill or an IUD, something that's more, or another hormonal method that's much more secure. So if you're going to use a method like a diaphragm or cervical cap or condoms, then you're facing a higher, something like a 20% pregnancy rate. So to get the pregnancy rate down to the same sort of numbers as birth control pills or hormonal methods, you can consider, some people do the tables where they figure in abortion, early abortion as a backup.
These numbers though, 20%, that means the more sex you have using that, the more likely you're gonna get pregnant, right? But if you only have, so it's like you have 100 possibilities and first time you have sex, you use one of the 80 that's not, you're not going to get pregnant, and then the next time you use another one of the 80, and the next, is that how it works? Is that what this means? And then all of a sudden you get one of the 20s and you're pregnant.
No, you're going to, well, that's a good question about this.
Are there any, do you know where somebody's
going to
be
watching the
same?
And it's always kind of baffling when they talk about the 20% failure rate. So,
Well, the failure rate is based on the number of people at risk having intercourse at a rate of 3 times a week for however many times a year. So, I have a textbook that I could look up.
Yeah,
the number for you, because it's an interesting question.
Yeah, okay.
The thing that I have noticed is in my clinical practice is that people will frequently say, well, I've been using a diaphragm for 15 years and I've never gotten pregnant, and so I must not be fertile. They stop using the diaphragm, they want to get pregnant, they get pregnant the first month. So it really does work. Barrier methods really do work if you're compulsive about it.
But for that person, over that period of time, they had sex 1,000 times and they didn't get pregnant. So so that doesn't really reflect the percentage that you're giving us. Because you think that eventually they're going to pull one of these, 10% or 15% because they're having sex a lot. So it doesn't quite make sense to me. It would frighten me ever to have sex if it has anything short of
100%. 100%, right.
You think, well, dude, I'm going to pull one of those, 3%.
Right.
3 out of 100, but you could get one of those. So why, you never have sex.
Right. Well, obviously it's a compelling activity. People are very anxious to do it. And the only way, obviously, to be 100% sure is not to have sex with another person. Not to have heterosexual intercourse with another person, although, of course, there are, you know, the few occasions of people who didn't quite go all the way, as we used to call it, and still got pregnant, so that can happen occasionally. There is also, of course, declining fertility, which I didn't show you, but for, you know, fertility rates definitely decline as we get older. Somewhere in the, I don't have a good statistic on that at my fingertips, but fertility rates take a dive at age 38. Actually, they start to fall at 30, and they take another nosedive at 38, which is a little earlier than we used to think it was, which is disconcerting for a lot of women who are waiting to have their pregnancies. So I used to say very blithely, oh, you know, when women would ask me, how long can I wait to have a baby? And I would say, well, you know, you can have a healthy baby when you're 42 or 43 or 44. But after seeing a lot of women trying very hard to get pregnant in their late 30s and having trouble, it's clear that that's probably a little too long to wait. Does anyone have questions about the birth control methods? And I'll go on to the
Did you mention about natural family planning? I
talked about that a little bit at the beginning. And what I said about that was that it is a decent method for people who are willing to give a lot of attention to daily changes in their menstrual cycle and really paying close attention. But probably still has about a 20%, based on the kind of statistics that I was quoting, 20 or 25% pregnancy rate. Compared
based
to
on
eight,
failure.
Right. That those would be the pregnancy, 20 or 25%. Pregnancies compared to 85%, which would be the baseline pregnancy rate for people who don't use any kind of birth control. Anybody have any idea what the most common STD would be, the most common sexually transmitted infection? What's it?
Herpes now? Or
herpes? Herpes is very, very common. And part of the reason that you find so many people who have it is because everybody who's ever had it still has it. So the number of something like 30 million Americans are infected with the herpes virus. Yeah, that's a lot. Probably the people who are transmitting it don't realize that they have it, and that's quite common. What it causes is initially a painful sore. It can be anywhere on the genital area or around the anus, and you can have sores around the anus without ever having had anal intercourse. It can occur anywhere around there. Usually the first infection lasts about 12 days, and it can be accompanied by an illness that seems like a cold or flu, aches and pains, fever, really just feeling exhausted. I think that's part of the reason that some people don't realize that they have it, because they just think they're having an awful flu and they don't notice that they have sores on their genitals at the same time. Many people, probably most people who get infected with the herpes virus, are going to have recurrent episodes. Usually they come more frequently in the first year, and as time goes by, the frequency tends to diminish. But some people keep having recurrences every month or 2 months or 3 months for many, many years. It's not, those episodes are milder than the first one, and they're not dangerous, they're just a pain in the neck. They're annoying. There are two kinds of herpes, herpes type 1 and herpes type 2, and we tend to think of herpes type 1 as being the kind that gives you cold sores, and herpes type 2 is the kind that occurs in the genital area. But in fact, you can get either one. If you take cultures of these kind of sores on the mouth, they can be type 2 as well as type 1, and vice versa. You're more likely to get recurrences if you get the genital kind than the oral kind, and you're more likely to get recurrences if you have the type 2 version of the genital area. There is a drug, there are a couple drugs now that can be used to shorten the duration of the recurrences so it's not so uncomfortable. One is called acyclovir or Zovirax. There's a couple of newer ones that work very well. unfortunately, they don't get the virus out of your system. So they just are specifically for symptoms, shortening the duration of symptoms. And herpes doesn't cause cervical cancer, which is something that was, what we thought about 15 or so years ago, 20 years ago. What does cause cervical cancer is the most common viral sexually transmitted infection in terms of new infections turning up. Anybody know what that is?
A new one?
It's called, yeah, another one. This is called human papillomavirus, or HPV. And this is caused, this causes genital warts. So it's actually the same virus that causes warts on your hands or your feet. There are about 75 different types of this virus, and about 8 or so of those types cause genital warts. Some of them are warts on the outside that look just like warts you have on your hands or elsewhere on your skin, and some of them are warts that occur on the cervix. These, and they can occur inside the urethra in men or around the anus or other areas on men. This is one of those problems that, one of those infections that causes much worse problems for women than it does for men. Mm-hmm. Because women have a particular area on the cervix that's especially vulnerable to the infection by this virus. And when that virus attacks that particular area on the cervix, it can cause cervical cancer precursors, what we call dysplasia, a precancerous condition, and it can cause cervical cancer. So basically, what we think that all cases of cervical cancer are ultimately caused by this virus. And this is probably the sexually transmitted infection that the fewest people know about, which is really a shame because it's causing a lot of problems for a lot of women. In fact, this is probably the one I see the most often in my practice, is this virus. It's also called condyloma. Condyloma acuminata is the name for the warts that can occur on the outside of the vagina. This is something that when they've done some very careful specialized tests of DNA, they've taken swabs from the cervix and looked for DNA of this virus, they have found it in up to 50% of all sexually active women. So they can find evidence of the virus. Doesn't necessarily mean that they either had an abnormal pap smear or they had warts that you could see, but they had evidence of having been exposed to this virus, which is really a problem because we don't have a specific treatment for it.
Can you find that in a pap smear?
Yes. Yeah, that's one of the important reasons for having a pap smear because that's how it can be detected. Sometimes we find in the pap smear evidence of the virus without any evidence of there being any precancerous changes going on. So then we watch it very carefully because we don't have a treatment that will specifically get rid of the virus itself. When it has caused precancerous changes or cancer, obviously we treat that, usually by removing or destroying the abnormal tissue on the cervix. But this is something that has, potentially big impact for women, and I have seen this kind of infection, carcinoma in situ, which is a very localized form of early cancer on the cervix in 13 and 14-year-olds. Oh, wow. So it is a much higher incidence in women who start having sex earlier and who have multiple partners. Using condoms is probably the best protection against this, next to abstinence. But unless you use that female condom that we showed that would protect the outside of the vulva, using a condom would not necessarily protect you completely. So the outside of your genital area can still be exposed to viruses that would be on the outside of the man that's not covered by a condom. So condoms are the best thing we have for this, but still not perfect, of course. The most common bacterial sexually transmitted infection is chlamydia, which is another one that not everybody has heard about. We used to think of STDs being gonorrhea and syphilis, and gonorrhea is common, but not actually as common as chlamydia. Chlamydia actually has a much higher incidence in younger women, And when they do screening tests, like in student health services and colleges, where they screen every woman who comes in, they find quite a high incidence of it, unfortunately. This one, thank goodness, is completely curable, treatable with antibiotics, and there are some new antibiotics that only take one dose to cure it. The chlamydia is, the symptoms would be having a vaginal discharge, having pain with urination, and sometimes it isn't detected until it's actually caused pelvic inflammatory disease or an infection up inside the uterus and the fallopian tubes. And when it gets to that stage, then it's not infrequently causes infertility because the tubes are blocked, or is a cause of tubal pregnancy because the tubes have been damaged. Gonorrhea, again, something like 1.5 million cases a year. Chlamydia, 4 million new cases a year. The symptoms of gonorrhea are just the same as the symptoms for chlamydia. And many people who turn out to have gonorrhea also have chlamydia at the same time. Women who, up to 40% of untreated women who get gonorrhea will end up with PID. And men can get complications of gonorrhea more so than chlamydia, with infections in the urethra, scarring in the urethra, and infertility.
PID?
PID is pelvic inflammatory disease. That's the infection up inside the fallopian tubes. I have some pictures here that I can show you when I get through. We can pass it around, get through talking about them. Syphilis is a really bad one, but only affects about 40,000 people a year. The problem about syphilis is that many people will miss the first sign of it, which is a painless sore, an open sore on the genital area, and then that can progress and actually become neurosyphilis, where it affects the brain. This is the thing that you might hear in the news about the Tuskegee men in the Tuskegee Institute years ago that weren't infected with. I mean, the government didn't infect them with syphilis, but they didn't treat them when they had neurosyphilis to sort of see what the sequelae of that infection was.
What happens with the brain infection?
It can cause neurological damage. They can get paralysis and weakness of the limbs and mental problems as well. And syphilis is highly treatable with penicillin. Very easy to treat with a shot of penicillin if it's recognized early on. Mm-hmm. Syphilis has more recently been more of a problem in gay men than it has in the heterosexual population. There are several vaginal infections that I wanted to mention. The most common ones are yeast infections or candidiasis, which is commonly occurs after taking antibiotics because it changes the different bacteria and other organisms in the vagina, but can occur as a sexually transmitted infection as well. Trichomonas, which is usually a sexually transmitted infection, that's a little parasite that swims around. And bacterial vaginosis, which is important because it can be associated with higher rates of complications after other kinds of procedures, like after childbirth, so women who have bacterial vaginosis beforehand should be treated for that before they have any kind of procedure done. Mm. And the problem is that the symptoms of all these infections are pretty similar. Vaginal discharge that may be irritating, may be itchy, may have an odor. And one thing that's going on now is that the treatment for yeast infections is available over the counter. You can go into the drugstore and buy Monistat or Gynelotrimid, which is great, if what you have is a yeast infection. But you need to be really sure that's what it is before you use that treatment. Or use the treatment, and if it's not better, then you need to get checked out. Because you could have gonorrhea, you could have chlamydia, you could have these other vaginal infections that aren't going to be treated by the over-the-counter stuff. One of the things that I wanted to mention that I think is really important is hepatitis B, which many people don't realize is a sexually transmitted infection. You can get hepatitis from something like a needle stick. People get it in who work in the healthcare field. Drug abusers can get it from sharing needles. But it turns out that one of the most common ways of getting is from sexual transmission. When I was an intern 15 or 20 years ago, we started testing all women who were pregnant to see if they were carriers of hepatitis B, because mainly we were testing Southeast Asian immigrants, because they had a very high incidence of being carriers of hepatitis B. And we found out when we started testing more people that we couldn't tell who was going to get it based on what the risk factors were. So we thought it was Southeast Asian immigrants and healthcare workers and people who worked in dialysis units and people with a history of IV drug abuse. We thought those were the only ones who would have it. But in fact, there was a high incidence of having that virus in the general population. So now newborns are being vaccinated for hepatitis B. And those of us who didn't get the vaccination or didn't fall into a high risk group really should get the vaccine. It's a very safe vaccine. The major drawback is that you have to have 3 injections. So you get one injection, and you get another one in a month, and you get another one in 6 months from the first one. And I checked with Helsa, the nurse here, and she said that the Holden policy is to offer the vaccine to people that are at perceived to be at high risk because they're working with sewage or the people that work in the garbage area. Mm-hmm. But I would encourage everyone to get the vaccine. I'm sorry, I keep saying get the virus. To get the vaccine, because you just never know what you're going to come in contact with, either in your daily life. You know, you may come upon someone who's bleeding and you're trying to help them, that sort of thing. Or if you're sexually active at all, I would recommend getting the vaccine. For people that work here that wanted to get it, you could get it. If you have insurance, you know, you could get it covered by your insurance at home and have the medication shipped up here in Helsinki that can administer it for you.
Once you have that, do you have to have that ever again?
Once you have the vaccine?
Right.
No.
Oh, so you're just no. Forever?
Yeah. The vaccine that's available now is quite effective and long-lasting.
It's a vaccine for what now?
Hepatitis B.
Okay.
Hepatitis is an infection of the liver, and it's incurable. There's no treatment for it. And the major problem with it is that when you get the illness, it's a bad one. You know, people can be ill for months with hepatitis. But the major problem is that it is transmissible during pregnancy. If a woman is a carrier of the virus, she can transmit it to the baby. And someone who's born with the virus has a much higher incidence of liver cancer and cirrhosis. And people who are chronic carriers of the virus can develop cirrhosis and liver cancer later in life as well. Mm-hmm. And it's a completely preventable condition. I don't have a lot of time left, and I don't want to talk for a lot of time about HIV. Everybody knows that HIV and AIDS is a serious infection. It can kill you. And we've been learning about how to protect ourselves against that. The fastest growing segment of AIDS cases is women age 15 to 44 who are at risk because of heterosexual transmission. So this is something that we need to be real careful about. A few years ago, people who were in the know about AIDS were saying, oh, these women are just getting so worried about it. They have nothing, you know, these middle class women are fussing about HIV and they're not really at risk. But it turns out not to be the case. So I think it's worth worrying about and being real careful about. In 9 cities in the country, AIDS is the leading cause of death in women aged 25 to 44. So if somebody dies of AIDS when they're 25 or 26, they must have gotten the virus when they were a teenager. Mm-hmm. So, because it takes a while for it to develop. Using condoms and spermicide provides excellent protection against HIV because the spermicides are also effective against the virus, the HIV virus. So I have some, anybody want a condom sample? Take a look at what they look like if you haven't seen one. condoms are really the best protection against all of the STDs that I mentioned. And I think that the best practice is to never have sex without a condom unless you're in a long-term, mutually monogamous relationship with someone that you trust thoroughly. And I don't think that sort of trust can develop until it's been a long period of time. So early on, even in a relationship that seems like a mutually monogamous one, I still think it's a good idea to use condoms for a long time. Mainly because of the STDs that I mentioned that people aren't really aware of. You may say, oh, we both went and had an HIV test, we're fine. We can have unprotected intercourse now. Not a good idea. You may be fine to not get HIV, but you may get cervical cancer, you may get these other kinds of conditions. So I think using condoms is something that needs to happen with every encounter. If a man says, oh, I don't like condoms, I can't feel anything, tough. Mm-hmm. Get used to it. Mm-hmm. And I think that men who get used to using condoms every time, that's just what it feels like. That's what sex feels like. Mm-hmm. And we just have to be real, real clear about that.
May I ask you a question?
Yeah.
If you were madly in love with somebody that you knew was HIV positive, and you wanted to commit adultery with them, would you trust a condom and spermicide to keep you safe?
Would I?
Yeah.
No, I wouldn't.
Why not?
Because it's not nothing's 100%, but. It's a very high rate, at least in the laboratory. You know,
one of the people that I know back home was in charge of education in the state of Minnesota. He works with the health department, and I asked him that same question. He's in charge of, in particular, sexually transmitted diseases. Mm-hmm. And I said, if you were madly in love with somebody who was HIV positive and wanted to commit adultery with them, what? Would you trust a condom? He said, well, maybe six or seven of them, but then it wouldn't be any fun.
Right.
I've heard this story told about when there was a gathering of healthcare professionals, a large room full of them, and that question was put to them, and there was only one person in the room who said they would trust a condom. My point is that we keep talking about safe sex.
Right.
And it's not safe.
No, it's not.
It's safer.
Right. Exactly.
But it's not safe. And it's a real misnomer, and I think it's kind of misleading people when we say this is safe.
Well, sex. That's my point, actually, is that you can't necessarily count on these methods to protect you from HIV, and you certainly can't count on them to protect you from all these other things. So HIV is, obviously the worst thing you can get. And there are people, I know patients who have partners that are HIV positive and they continue to have a sexual relationship with them and have not gotten infected. But I wouldn't take that chance personally. Although it is true that there are new drugs that are being used for HIV which are extending life and, may even turn out to be long-term maintenance drugs that will allow people with HIV to live indefinitely. And that's just within the last 5 years that's happening. That's really exciting. But, these are very expensive drugs and you have to take them every 4 hours or something like that. It's still a huge lifestyle factor, that even though it doesn't cause death anymore. I have some pictures of a few of these conditions if you want to take a look at some of these things. This is what herpes looks like. Frequently, it's only one or two sores. This would be a primary episode with a bunch like this. This is lots of genital warts.
You see this a lot?
Which?
All of these?
Yes.
Wow.
I would say I probably see one patient a day with bacterial vaginosis, which is usually sexually transmitted. I see at least one patient a day with something related to HPV, either warts on the outside or cervical problems, pap smear problems related to the papillomavirus.
Tell me what a pap smear is.
A pap smear is a test where we scrape some cells from the cervix to open the uterus. and that is to look for cervical cancer precursors. The whole beauty of the test is that we can detect these changes when they're in the process of development before they've actually become cervical cancer. So the availability of the pap smear, which has been, I think, since the 20s or 30s that we've had it, has significantly reduced the death rate from cervical cancer.
You just look at these cells under the microscope?
I don't, the lab does.
The lab does?
Uh-huh.
That's all it is?
Yeah. And the cells that are shed from the cervix have this, you know, it's a convenient thing that they can look at them and see that they're not cancerous, but precancerous.
Once a year?
We do it once a year. Once a year. And so for women who are at risk for cervical cancer because they're sexually active, whether it's with their husband or with other partners, it's real important to have a pap smear every year because these kinds of things can develop. And I would have to say that in the last couple of weeks, I've treated at least two women that immediately come to mind who were in their one was in her 50s, the other was in her 60s. Both had been married for at least 30 years, and both had evidence of this human papillomavirus on their cervix. My impression, my suspicion is that their husbands had been infected with this virus somewhere else and had given it to them, although I don't push that explanation on people. They talked to their husbands, they said they hadn't been with anyone else. It is possible for the virus to be around for a long time before it shows itself. I think 30 years is probably pushing the outer limit of that possibility, but, you know, that's what people want to believe, you know, that's their business. But my point is that even though you think you may be, as I said, the only person's behavior you can control is your own. So if if you're having sex with anyone, you need to be having regular checkups to be sure things are safe. The other, and this sort of goes to your point, I saw a patient last week who is on birth control pills and practices safer sex every time she has intercourse, and she has a boyfriend that she's been with for 9 months or something like that. And she came in to see me with some bumps on the labia, and it turned out to be kind of an infrequent STD called molluscum contagiosum, which is another little thing that causes bumps. And I see it maybe once a year, not very common. And she had at least 30 of these bumps all over. I had never seen that many. And this woman was really devastated because she was doing, you know, everything that she knew to do to keep herself safe. And I don't say this to scare you, but just so that you're aware that there are consequences. And that's why it's so important to be, you know, to be thoughtful about who you're with and what you're doing, because you just can never be 100% sure about it. The treatment for those molluscum spots is, I tried freezing them with liquid nitrogen, 30 little freezes, and I did that 2 weeks in a row, and that didn't work. And the thing that really works for those is to take a needle and open, kind of pop them open, because there's a little infected thing inside that if you get it out, they'll heal. So I did 30 little pinpricks there, so that was kind of noxious for her. Does anybody have any questions about anything on this happy note? Any other questions?
Are you from the Seattle area?
Yes.
Are they doing much in your schools with abstinence education? Emotion of abstinence?
Yeah, I'm not sure about that. My son is going to be in fifth grade next year, and that's going to be the beginning of his family life, sex ed curriculum. I'm not sure exactly what it's like.
They're promoting that in a pretty big way back in our schools in Wisconsin.
Uh-huh. I think it's an excellent thing to promote for kids. I brought along some brochures that HELSA has up outside the first aid station. one of which, one of which is called Many Teens Are Saying No, on exactly that topic, and some other ones about birth control and STDs. So these are available right here in the village. And I think that's, I think those are good things to take a look at. People, you know, there may be a lot of people that are interested in these topics but don't want to go to a public discussion about it. So spread the word that there's information up there. And I think, I don't think we can say enough about abstinence.
Well, for adults, as too.
Yeah.
I was 32 years old when I got married and I had my first experience with sex. I was a virgin at 32. And I lived a happy life.
Right.
You know, I didn't explode.
Right.
There's lots of us around.
Uh-huh. Yeah, that's true. That's true. Uh-huh.
Do a lot of these things also obtain for oral sex? Because a lot of people who are doing oral sex is thought to be safer. I mean, you don't get pregnant from oral sex.
Right, right.
But these disease-y kinds of things, are they...
Some of these things you can, that are transmissible.
Like herpes, obviously.
Yeah, herpes is transmissible, so is warts. Mm-hmm. It is possible to get warts in the throat from oral sex, although it's much less common than genital warts.
HIV would be too.
HIV would be too.
They were saying it was less of a, I mean, 10 years ago, but it isn't less likely, it isn't less infectious in oral sex.
I think it probably is, but it depends on whether there's breaks in the mucous membrane, or, you know, in both situations. The safer sex technique for oral sex with women and for between women is to use a piece of latex, which is
a dental dam.
Yeah, it's something that dentists use to wall off the rest of the area. So you can buy these and use that up against the.
So that is a concern with lesbians as well.
It is.
There are diseases that just pass.
Right. I think that, in my experience anyway, it's much less common for lesbians to be using any of these protective techniques because they perceive that their risk is lower.
Yeah.
And in fact, the vast majority of HIV cases in lesbians are in women that are also IV drug abusers. Mm-hmm. So it's not very common to be transmitted. Most of these diseases are difficult to transmit back and forth from woman to woman.
How about yeast infections?
Uh-huh.
Can those be transmitted through oral sex?
Yes.
Too, and then be carried?
Yes. But it's unusual for a man to be a carrier of yeast unless he's diabetic. So that's not a real common.
She's kind of funny though, because the whole presentation was based on the idea that intercourse is what you do when you have sex.
Right. Right.
Which that hadn't occurred to me that that's what. I mean, that's, you know.
It hadn't occurred to you that that's what it would be, or that that's the only way to.
That's the only way to. I mean, in general, if you're involved with somebody, it takes a lot of talking to figure out the preventive measures that you're going to use,
right.
Whatever, unless the person's already on the pill. But,
right.
But so
right.
you just kind of play around for like up 2 months,
right.
Sometimes 6 months, and you know, then you finally say, well, maybe time to think about what we're doing here.
Right, right. Yeah, it's kind of surprising how few people actually discuss it beforehand. I mean, who've been into it.
That's one of the things that would be real helpful is just to get people to say, touch this stuff and talk about this stuff.
Right, exactly. So you know what you're dealing with. And obviously, all sexual relationships don't have to involve intercourse, but most do. And most of these, you know, pregnancy and the other things we're talking about are related to that. So
yeah, well,
you certainly can be a lot more.
The question for me is that it seems to me that the dilemma for a lot of women is that. Sexual intercourse with a man frequently that it just doesn't yield the kind of satisfaction that, I mean, especially if you're not practiced, if you aren't a couple that's worked together a lot, so the man has his orgasm and loses interest and you're just sitting there, you know. So I would say, if I were a woman, I would just say, no, we're not having intercourse.
Uh-huh.
Not for another 6 months.
Let's get the rest of this figured out.
Yeah, let's get some pleasure stuff figured out here. Let's have some fun, and we're not going to intercourse.
that goes back.
Married first.
Huh?
Hopefully get married.
Yeah. Getting married first would be fine. Yeah. It goes back to what I was saying at the beginning about honoring yourself and honoring your body and being sure that it's something that's really going to be, you know, is it worth it?
Mm-hmm.
You know, is it going to end up the way I want to?
One of our most important elements in a fantastic sex life is commitment.
Right.
Commitment to
right.
One another.
Right. Because once you're committed to one another and you're committed to being together, then you can figure out how to get around, you know, things that go wrong and how to make it work in certain situations and make it a lifelong process. And I think that, you know, a lot of young people have this idea that older people aren't having sex, but they're the only ones who are. Wrong. And the other thing is that the more regular your sex life is, the better it will be and the longer it will last. So that couples who are sexually active into their 80s and later are, you know, physically more able to do so. You know, if you don't...